Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN Information Service here in Geneva. Today is Friday, 6th of December. And I would like to start immediately with Pascal, who has an update on the Human Rights Council.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. I have a few announcements for you. The UN Human Rights Council will hold two meetings on Monday, December 9. First, at 10 a.m., the Council will hear an oral update from Deputy High Commissioner Nada Al-Nashif on the human rights situation in Nicaragua. And this oral update will be followed by an interactive dialogue with UN member states. The same day, in the afternoon at 3 p.m., the Human Rights Council will hold an organizational session regarding its 19th cycle that will begin on January 1st, 2025. The items on the agenda of these organizational sessions are the election of the next president of the Human Rights Council and of the Bureau, and the adoption of a presidential statement on the Council efficiency. The Council will be also asked to pronounce itself on the appointment of the new Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous People following the resignation of José Francisco Calitzai. On Friday, December 13, at 3 p.m., the Human Rights Council will hold an interactive dialogue on the human rights situation in Venezuela. It will hear from High Commissioner Volker Türk. And I just want to remind you that we had a meeting on Ukraine scheduled on December 13 as well, but this meeting was postponed to January 2025. We don't have the new date and time yet, but we'll let you know as soon as it is official. Et juste pour vous rappeler que la Journée internationale des droits de l'homme aura lieu le mardi 10 décembre. À cette occasion, le président du Conseil des droits de l'homme de l'ONU, l'ambassadeur Omar Schneeber, participera à une discussion sur les droits des personnes handicapées avec à peu près 80 élèves des écoles publiques du canton de Genève. Cette réunion aura lieu dans la salle 20. Elle est co-organisée par l'ONUG avec le soutien de l'Organisation mondiale pour la propriété intellectuelle. Merci.
Merci Pascal. Est-ce qu'il y a des questions? Nick, pardon, j'aurais dû regarder la salle avant, mais non. Nick.
Yeah, thank you for that. Pascal, could you just explain what the genesis of this Nicaragua meeting was? How did that come to be called and convened? And could you just also indicate what were the reasons for the delay of the Ukraine session? Thank you.
Yes, sure, Nick. The Council's resolution on Nicaragua mandates the High Commissioner to present an oral update, I think if I'm not wrong, 4 presentation a year. And since this 4th oral update happens outside a regular session, that's why we're holding it in December. This is something that has been happening for several years now. Regarding Ukraine, yes, the meeting is postponed to January 2025. Last Monday, the president of the Human Rights Council received a letter from the High Commissioner asking him for the postponement of this meeting, and the High Commissioner explained that it was due to operational constraints and that because of this, his office is not in a position to submit the periodic report on time for December 13. So the request from the High Commissioner for this postponement will enhance the quality and the reliability of the information that will be presented to the Human Rights Council and better guide the interactive dialogue that is expected after this update.
Laurent?
Oui, merci Pascal. Juste pour vérifier l'élection du président, ce sera bien le premier point à l'ordre du jour lundi.
Ce sera parmi les premiers points à l'ordre du jour, mardi, avec la réunion qui commence à 15h. Oui, l'élection du bureau.
Merci, Pascal. And before we close the human rights chapter, just to remind you, the press conference of High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, on Monday morning at 10:30 in this room. And we also have another one for the week, for next week, the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. They will present you the review of the findings on Armenia, Ecuador, Greece, Kenya, Monaco, and Saudi Arabia with the 4 members of the committee, and that will be on Friday, at 9:15 before the briefing. And the Committee on the Protection of the Rights of All Migrant Workers and Members of Their Family is concluding this morning the report of Seychelles, and that will be the last one on their agenda. I think human rights-wise we have... Oh, Gabriela, you have a question for Pascal or for me? I don't know.
Do you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you so much. Good morning, Alessandra. I just want to know if the state of Nicaragua already confirmed the assistance to Monday's session. And also on Venezuela, does the High Commissioner has observers or someone that is going to be there on the 10th of January when the new president will take the post? Thank you.
I will get back to you on the official participation of Nicaragua, but what we've seen from previous meeting is that we had a representative of the government participating remotely from Managua, but I will double check this and get back to you, Gabriela. Regarding your second question, I think it's a question that you should better ask Ravina. And
or directly Volker Turk, I commission Volker Turk on Monday, maybe
exactly.
That's the best. Okay. So let's go ahead, sorry, and welcome our first guest from WHO. Margaret is connected online, and Dr. Rick Peppercorn is joining us from Gaza to tell us about the health situation there. Rick, good morning. Welcome. You have the floor.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone, and greetings from Gaza, from Darabella. I want to focus on two areas. First, about the extremely concerning information which reaches us from Kamala One. And secondly, I want to raise some issues on medical evacuation and medevac. So what we receive now from information, and it is difficult to analyze what and how, but this information is actually from the emergency medical team which served in Kamala One, and other sources. So early in the morning, so first of all night, there was heavy bombing around the hospital, around Kamala One. Early in the morning, around 4 o'clock, there was an IDF tank seen outside the hospital. And through people, they were kind of informed and told that everyone had to move outside of the hospital. This kind of resulted in panic, and what we understand that people started to climb the wall and to escape, and of course and this panic attracted IDF fire. There's reported death and also detentions, arrests, and the bulk of the people were directed to walk towards the main what is called the Beit Lahia Street, and from there to the Saladin and eventually to the Saladin checkpoint. Now, the debriefing with the emergency medical team, Mercy, that's an Indonesian emergency medical team, it was unclear that there was we see all kind of messages that there was an official evacuation request by the higher levels, etc., from IDF. That is unclear. The hospital is what we got from the EMT was left like the way it was. That's not intact because it has been damaged before. The hospital director and a number of staff and a number of patients are still in the hospital. And when Mercy, the emergency medical team, Mercy left, they didn't see at that moment IDF soldiers outside the hospitals. For WHO and together with our colleagues from OCHA, we reached out to CLA and COGAT, well, first of all, of course, to ensure the protection of the facility. We also, as WHO, coordinated the movement of a Ministry of Health ambulance that picked up the 6 internationals and the 1 nationals that worked with the emergency medical team, Mercy from Indonesia. And they reached at 9 o'clock this morning, they reached the public aid hospital safe. And at the debriefing, they they mentioned to my colleagues who are with me that, of course, the security situation was tense already for days. Panic caused by the bombing and shelling, along with the panic crowd inside the hospital. So the EMT also felt very unsafe and that they should follow the bulk of the people to abandon the hospital. It's important to know that the hospital director did not ask the EMT to leave, in contrary, and did not follow them. So our plea, like always, is health facilities, hospitals, health workers, and everyone related, ambulances, should never be a target, should never be attacked. They should be protected. They're a place for the needy, the sick, and people should feel safe. Unfortunately, what we've seen in specifically over the last weeks, I would say month, in the north, in Gaza, that the access to Kamal Adwan Indonesian Hospital and Al Ada was very severely restricted. We've had many of our missions actually denied, impeded, etc. However, I want to, and also what we understand, for example, yesterday on the 5th of December, that also on the report that Quad Copper carried out an attack actually on Kamal Adwan or in Beit Lahia. And according to the Ministry of Health, a 60-year-old patient was killed while she was taken on a wheelchair to the X-ray department. And 12 other people were injured, including 2 health personnel. That's reported to us, and one has a sustained serious injury. I want to say, and this makes it, I think, even more confusing for us. So on the between 30th November and the 2nd December, so WHO and partners, we conducted missions. So only a couple of weeks ago, myself, I was in Gaza for almost 4 weeks, and I was part of 4 missions, 4 of the 7, we had planned 7 missions, and we finally managed 4, to Kamal Adwan and to Al Ada, to do the things we always do, try to bring in fuel, medical supplies, blood, food for patients, staff. Sometimes we were sometimes denied to take anything, and also to take critical patients out to Shifa and to other places. Now, only we planned for a number of missions in between, a number of them denied and impeded, but on between the 30th November and 2 December, so just a few days ago, the WHO parts conducted these missions to the north of Gaza, and they delivered fuel supplies, including food parcels and support. And they, so we brought the emergency medical team, Mercy, to Kamal Adwan. Just recently, we just had less than a week ago, and brought 10,000 liters of fuel, food parcels for patients, the staff, blood units, etc., including this EMT. And the EMT deployment had been denied for at least 5 times over the past 2 weeks. So they're just there, and now within 1 week, they're gone again. This is not only, for me, incomprehensible, but also incredibly sad. I mean, a very brave EMT who actually is being deployed through WHO and support together with fuel, medical supplies and everything to there. And they had 2 surgeons, 2 emergency nurses, 1 gynecologist and a logistician. And now within 1 week, they are forced, they feel forced and threatened, probably scared, and they left already. On that same mission, I just want to mention also WHO delivered 24,000 liters of fuel and medical supplies to Shifa for onward distribution to the hospitals in Gaza. Because Gaza City, with all the new IDPs from the north, has grown considerably. I mean, we talk about 350,000 people plus, etc. There's a number of a few medical facilities, Shifa, and a few other hospitals, of course, in the neighborhood, Al Ahli, the public aid hospital, Al Hilu, and a few primary healthcare points. And they are becoming more and more important, and they need to be constantly resupplied. We also did a medical transfer, 3 critical patients from Kamal Adwan to Shifa, and 7 patients and 18 companions from Gaza City to the European Gaza Hospital and Nasser Medical Complex for the international medical evacuation to Jordan and the US that took place on the 3rd December. We had another medevac as well. So this brings me to the second point, what I want to raise on medevac, medical evacuations. So we, WHO continues to support medical evacuation outside Gaza. And since 7th of October 2023, in total 5,325 patients have been evacuated outside Gaza. But of that, almost 5,000 were evacuated via the Rafah crossing before the 7th of May, including 4,000 children. So at least we estimate that at least 12,000 patients across Gaza still need medical evacuations to survive or to get the treatment they need. We talk about roughly probably half to 40% trauma patients and things, spinal injury, amputations, burns, which need a lot of new reconstructive, more specialized operations. But also a huge part is non-communicable diseases, specifically oncology, specifically cancer. So we urge, of course, since the Rafah crossing closure on the 7th May of 2024, only 378 patients have been evacuated outside Gaza. 331 through WHO support, and then on top of that, all the companions. Of these, 217 were children. And again, the top five medical needs of those evacuated through WHO since that time, they include, as I said, almost more than 40% is actually cancer-related, more than 25% trauma, 8% congenital anomalies, and 7% cardiac diseases and ophthalmology. And the destinations since then, UAE, by far tops, that is 266, US 22, Jordan 20, Romanian 15, and Belgium 5. I want to remind everyone that prior to the current crisis, between 50 and 100 patients per day were evacuated outside Gaza to get specialized treatment. Again, the bulk of them, 40% oncology related, but also a lot of other. And they mainly went to the East Jerusalem hospitals and to the West Bank. So this has been our plea and our request all the time. We are completely ready to get into much more organized medevac on a weekly basis or twice a week or three times a week, etc. Because if we continue in this pace, we will be medevacing for the next 5 to 10 years. This needs to change. So we request for proper medical corridors. The first one to restore the traditional referral pathway to East Jerusalem and West Bank, but also and to restore the referral pathway to Egypt and possibly Jordan. I want to leave it here and, of course, open for questions. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Rick. That was really exhaustive. I'll turn to the journalist in the room. Don't see any question. Online, John Zero Costas, France 24, and The Lancet.
Good morning. Thank you, Rick. I was wondering, given that this week it's at WHO headquarters is a Disability Week, do you have an update on, you just mentioned the figure, from the 12,000, the number that need to be evacuated. How many of these are amputees? And did I get it correct? It's only the US have taken 22, did you mention? Have any been evacuated to the UK, to France or Germany?
Let me go back to that. I mean, like that's a good question. So on the data we have, I think there's two things. I mean, I think you've seen, let me first get back to the what you ask about how many amputees, etc. I don't have specific data on that. What we know, and I think we shared that also with you, I think you raised, I think, very questions on that in one of the former Palais briefing. There has been this WHO assessment, you know, like, okay, we talk about over 100,000 injuries in Gaza. So what does this injury contain about? And then with the assistance from the emergency medical team, was an assessment done between January and May. And based on that, I mean, like, you know, correcting for all the other figures, and that was quite shocking, that one quarter of those of all those trauma injuries were severe trauma injuries, actually life-changing injuries, which would need either additional operation and also support, lifelong support and rehabilitation. That's what we can say. Now, I just want to currently, so we estimate that 7% of the Gaza population is estimated to have some form of disabilities. Well, that is, of course, quite, and that is also has massive implication if hopefully we will ever talk about a ceasefire and early recovery and rehabilitation, etc., that we are already focusing on this and trying to focus on this. And you might remember that WHO supported for many years and invested more than 10 million in the Limb Reconstruction Center as part of Nasser. That got severely damaged and destroyed, but we are already working on that, like how can we improve some of the rehabilitation currently. Now, you asked about this. So the top five medical needs, I mentioned 44% cancer. That is from the 333 patients WHO managed to medevac outside Gaza, plus then you talk about, I think, another 500-600 companions, etc., since Rafah crossing was closed. That was 44% cancer-related, 25% trauma, 8% congenital, 7% cardiac disease, and 4% ophthalmology. And the top five for that group, I want to say that's the UAE with 266 patients, the US 22, Jordan 20, Romania 15, and Belgium 5. So I hope I addressed your question there. So yeah, I haven't indeed heard from any patients transferred. You ask about the UK or France. We know that the EU is willing to accept more patients, etc., and WHO is very much ready. We're very happy to hear that. We hope other countries and many other countries have stepped up, specifically in the region. Of course, we should not forget that Egypt took by far the bulk of the patients before the Rafah crossing is closed. UAE, I think we talk already about 1,000 patients plus or something like that. Also, I know in Oman and Jordan, but that was before. So what we hope to establish when there's proper medical corridors, that from there, so if there's patients can be medevaced to East Jerusalem hospitals, and for example, the West Bank hospitals, and then when there's a need, that from there, they can go somewhere else. The same, we need another corridor, again, reestablished to Egypt and to Jordan, because we're talking about an estimated 10, 12, 14,000 patients. We don't even know how many actually, but approximately 12,000. And in this space, we are doing it now. And it is, by the way, incredibly time consuming and management wise, a huge task for the WHO team here in Gaza, but also in Jerusalem, to do all the coordination. That's a massive. So we want to, and of course, when we do this kind of medevac, we prefer that we do it for 100 patients and then maybe with another 200 companion and one go, in instead of focusing on 7 or 8 patients, etc., which is almost the same amount of work, specifically in the very complex circumstances, a very challenging situation we work in. We, for all those medevacs, we collect the patients, for example, from the north, from the various places where they collect from Shifa, and then we bring them to the south and the night before, a couple of nights before, to European Gaza Hospital. So WHO also make sure there's medical care, a shelter, food, etc. Then we have to arrange all the transport. We do this together with our great partners of PRCS and other partners. We bring them up. Those are operations.
Thank you. Christian Ulrich, the German News Agency.
Thank you very much, Rick. I would like to go back to your first item, Kamala 1. I didn't quite understand. Did you say that there was an evacuation order at 4 o'clock in the morning, but you don't know where it came from or whether it was for real? Maybe you can elaborate a little bit on that. And the medical evacuation team, where did they come from and what were their nationalities? Thank you.
So the word no, what I said, I think then you missed it. Based on our information, and that is from various sources, including the emergency medical team who left the place, there's no official evacuation order. However, I think, first of all, heavy bombing around the hospital, very close to the hospital, all night. Then an IDF tank that's based on all the information outside the hospital. Then information which spread that all people had to leave the hospital, resulting in panic. And I've been there when it was close to their bone. I can really understand the panic and how scared people must be. So people started climbing the back wall to escape. And that panic again attracted IDF fire. That's what we understand. That's reported their death, detention, arrest, etc. But the bulk of people were directed to walk through the Beit Lahia street and from there to Saladin and the Saladin checkpoints. And the international emergency medical team, they left with that crowd. And they told us the information. So the hospital is still what we call minimum operational, with the hospital director there and a number of staff and a number of patients. So there's no evacuation of the hospital currently taking place. However, of course, what we are really concerned about first. This is happening constantly around Kamalat 1 and Al Ada Hospital, the only two hospitals north of Gaza, which what we call are minimal functional, already for weeks, I mean, say now actually already for months, which constantly have shortages of supplies, medical supplies, fuel, blood, etc. And as I said, I mean, already for when I was at a let's say 3-4 weeks ago, was there in the stretch for 4 weeks. We went four times to Kamalat 1, and I think twice we could bring in fuel, medical supplies, and some food, etc., and blood, and taking out the most critical patients. And what is, for me, a bit incomprehensible, that only a few days ago, that's only 4 or 5 days ago, a WHO mission was facilitated, again, to reach Kamalat 1, and bringing, what I said, bringing 10,000 liters of fuel, medical supply, blood, taking out patients, but also bringing in for the first time since months, this international emergency medical team. So that was facilitated. Composing of 2 surgeons, emergency nurses, and a gynecologist. And within 1 week, they feel forced, scared, whatever, to leave. I think that is extremely concerning and should never happen. I mean, like, that hospital should be operational, and WHO partners should be able to reach that hospital regularly, including Al Ada Hospital, to make sure they get their supplies and their fuel and they can be operational.
Indeed. Mohamed Aslan, Adandoluansi.
Thank you, Alessandra. My question will be about El Mawasi region. Margaret or Rick can answer for it. Recently, Israeli soldiers targeted the tents where displaced Palestinians are staying in El Mawasi region of Gaza. As a result of this, many people lost their life. My question is, how do you think these people can survive in winter condition when even their tents are being attacked? Thank you.
I didn't get The question. Sorry, I didn't get the question.
Mohammed was asking how they can survive in winter conditions.
Okay, so I think that's a good question, and of course we are very much also WHO. They always ask me questions about health, and of course because as WHO we are leading and coordinating the one UN and parts in health. But I personally, and coming here and so regular on long-term missions, I'm much more concerned currently about shelter and actually the conditions of shelter. So yeah, I think if I could ask the member states and everyone around us, the shelter and shelter items really need to get into Gaza and properly delivered at the places where it's needed. Now, so specifically, and I think we're focusing now on health, but the other areas, the fuel situation is again becoming precarious and very complex and difficult. Well, for everything we do here, fuel is the most important item. So that always should be there. So plea to anyone involved, regular supply of fuel, food. I mean, you've seen, and I think I'm sure you heard WFP and UNRWA, et cetera, all talking about the food and the food scarcity, the lack of diversity of food, et cetera. Also compounded by the security problem inside Gaza, the lack of policing, the lack of police, the looting, et cetera, massive area. And then, the everything around shelter, so the impediments of importation of supplies, yeah, and the closing of the Rafah border. I mean, that has been raised constantly, the Rafah crossing. That impedes, I mean, like a lot of the work we do. So we still discuss a lot of the same thing, lack of the humanitarian supplies getting into Gaza and then being distributed to the places where it's most needed within Gaza. On the other and furthermore, we have informed you, I think, in the past as well on infectious diseases, etc. It's difficult at the moment to get specific data. I want to ask that, but when people ask me, so are there epidemics? Of course, diarrheal diseases is more than 25 times as much as normal. Respiratory infections is way higher among under fives, et cetera, than normal. So that is specifically when you talk about winterization, the incredibly poor water and sanitation condition, which was one of the reasons we had actually polio as well in Gaza, et cetera, that compounds that. So yeah, we are quite concerned about that, the lack of proper winterization in Gaza. First and foremost, of course, what is needed is a ceasefire and that humanitarians can properly do their work all over Gaza.
Nick Cumming-Bruce, New York Times.
Yeah, thank you for taking the question. Rick, a couple of questions. One first in relation, you mentioned a quadcopter attack on Kamal Adwan. Is this confirmed by you, and was this an attack that was carried out on people within the premises of Kamal Adwan Hospital? That's my first question. And then I have two questions relating to Medivac. You've raised before this your concern to get the corridors back to East Jerusalem and so forth operating on a regular basis. When you raise that with Kogat, what is the response you are getting, number one? Second question is, I wonder, of all the patients who have been referred for medical evacuation, particularly since 7th of May, how many, if you know, how many have died while they were waiting for medical evacuation? Thank you.
Yeah, on this quadratrop attack, I said it very clearly, that's reported to us. So we cannot confirm because we didn't have a mission around that time, etc., and we didn't get that. Let's say that information. We always try to, and I think you should probably know, WHO, one of the mandates, etc., by the World Health Assembly, is that we monitor we analyze and we report on what we call attacks on healthcare. And so we try to get that from all kinds of sources. We never attribute where this is coming from, because we are not a crime investigating bureau. I want to stress that as well. We are not. So it's that's why we report like we do. So this got reported, so I cannot confirm that. On the medevac, so what we ask for is, as I said, these medical corridors. And yes, we have raised this with everyone, including very much also with Israeli authorities, that we want to restore this pathway to East Jerusalem and to the West Bank. Actually, just this week, there was a session on this in the Augusta Victoria Hospital, organized by the East Jerusalem hospitals. I attended as well. There were a lot of questions. They said, because they are ready to receive patients. They did that all the time in the past. And what I said, from the 300 patients we met, in fact, outside, 40% was related to oncology. They used to go always to Augusta Victoria Hospital and to some other places, sometimes in the West Bank. Now, we're talking about so many, many patients that only having the East Jerusalem and the West Bank would not be enough. So we have to definitely also get a medical corridor back to Egypt and possibly Jordan to really speed this up. We've raised this, and including with the Israeli authorities, they heard us. We raised this already for months, and you know they would they reflect on that. But currently, this is not approved. Now, on the we definitely are aware that patients die. I mean, and I think when this maybe stops at one stage and we get into this analysis, because we always look at the number of death and injured, because looking at the number of people actually who have, we look at people who have been killed and actually injured, but the people who have unnecessarily died, and I think there was once a long time ago already an assessment of that in the Lancet, etc., will be much larger. That's also, we know that we are aware that we have actually, I remember also that when we had a smaller group of patients, there was a child not so long time ago, which was on the list to be medevaced, et cetera. And then the day before the medevac or something like that, the child passed away. So definitely we don't have clear figures on that, unfortunately. Over to you.
Thank you very much. Nick, before I let you go, there is a follow-up in the chat from Christian, who's asking, where were the members of the emergency medical team from? And then we'll free you.
Thank you. Okay, they are from, so it's called the Mercy Indonesia. So there were 6 international, 1 national, and they are from, the internationals are from Indonesia. They worked, there's one of the many EMTs doing fantastic work. I mean, like that's, if I say what is a little bit of an incredible achievement, people always talk about polio. For me, the big achievement is the health workers in Gaza, together with emergency medical teams, with partners like WHO and other partners, that somehow in many places the health facilities and the health system is partly functional. And we know that many hospitals we discuss now, if you talk Shifa and Nasser Medical Complex, European Gaza Hospital, also Al-Ahli, even Kamal One in the past and Al-Ada, they all became from functional, partly functional, non-functional. They all bounced back because of that system of support. And WHO is a real proud partner. We've been massively supporting that, and that it is partly to minimal functional, absolutely not sufficient. There are still many people passing away and dying for no good reasons, because proper care is not available. Yeah. Many people who get sick, but still,
Sorry, there is also just a small thing to confirm for Reuters. Israel facilitating the Indonesian team's entry, right, or not?
It's an Indonesian team, and they're safe. They left Kamalat 1. We facilitated, and they are now actually camping in another hospital.
Thank you. Last question from AFP, then we go to the other guest. Agnès Pedrero. Sorry, Agnès.
Yes, hi, thank you for taking my question about Kamalat 1. Two questions. You say that there were no official order to evacuate, but that there were information that spread around for the people. Could you give us more... be more specific of where this information came first, and how many people are still inside the hospital now, if you have that number, and with the number of patients and doctors. Thank you.
Okay. You know what I think, so this is difficult so we need more information, but again, indeed, what we get, no official order for evacuation, yeah, but people being told, and then a rumor, then within amidst the panic and amidst the heavy bombardments over the night, etc., then that's, I think it spread that people had to leave and all the IDPs had to leave. And when they went out and they tried to escape, etc., and more panic and reported death, etc., they left. How many people left, we don't know, but it's a substantial amount. I mean, they left to Beit Lahia and to the Czech, but how many people are still in the hospital? We know that the hospital director is there, that there's some medical staff, and that there also still are patients in the hospital. So we will probably get more details on that today.
Thank you very much. Enrico, thanks so much for updating us on this very important situation. Good luck with with the next days. I'll go now to our next guest, who is Monica Totova, who is the senior economist at FAO. She's connecting from Astana to tell us about the monthly update on global food commodity prices. Sorry, madam, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. I realize good afternoon from Astana, good morning in Geneva. I realize that after Rick's briefing, my contribution to today's briefing is going to be very mundane. But nevertheless, I wanted to brief you on the latest developments of the FAO Food Price Index, which was released this morning. The index increased by 0.5% in November compared to its October level, reaching the highest level since April 2023. Price quotations for vegetable oils and dairy products rose, while those for meat, cereals, and sugar decreased. While, compared to historical levels, the food price index in November was 5.7% higher than its corresponding value a year ago, it remained over 20% below its peak of 160.2 points, which was reached in March 2022, which, as you might recall, was immediately following the start of the war in Ukraine. Focusing just in a slight detail on individual commodity groups, as I already mentioned, vegetable oil prices rose the most by over 7% in October, which was the second largest jump in 2 months, mostly on the account of tightening balance. Dairy prices also continued to increasing by rather contained 0.6% from September, led by a rebound global import demand for the whole milk powder. Butter prices seem to be reaching new records every month amid strong demand and tight inventories in Western Europe. Now going to the commodities where prices declined. Cereal prices declined by 2.7% to a level of 8% below 1 year earlier. Wheat prices declined amid weaker international demand and increased supply from the ongoing harvest in the Southern Hemisphere. Sugar, which has been in the news quite a bit in the last year or so due to its large fluctuation, the sugar price index declined by 2.5%, impacted by the start of the crushing season in India, in Thailand, and easing concerns about the sugar cane prospects in Brazil. Meat prices also declined. So FAO, in addition to the food price index, also released its cereal supply and demand brief, where every month we provide forecasts for global cereal production, consumption, trade, and stocks. So in the last release that was released today, currently forecast that the global cereal production will decline by around 0.6% from the previous year, which is a downward revision from our previous number, but it's still the second largest output on the record. As the agriculture year continues, although the calendar year is coming to the close, we are now also looking at the crops to be harvested in 2025. Softer wheat prices might mean that the area expansion of winter wheat crop, the planting of which is currently underway in the Northern Hemisphere, might not be as big. Last but not least, I would like to mention that the Agriculture Market Information System, the secretariat of which is hosted at FAO, released its monthly monitor today as well, featuring, in addition to regular analysis, a reflection on agricultural commodity markets in 2024 and looking forward to 2025, identifying uncertainties that could be potentially affecting global commodity markets. Obviously, high on the agenda remains extreme weather events, geopolitical tension, and uncertainty in the trade policy. I will leave it here, and I'm happy to answer any questions there might be. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sorry. Thank you very much, Monica. Let me see if there's any question for you. Yes, please, sir. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Thank you, Valusi. Thank you, Monica. This is Mr. Liang from China Economic Daily. I'm quite proud to report on FAO based in Geneva, though not personally in Rome. My question is related with the food prices or the bearing on food prices as a result of the undergoing transition in the agribusiness sector, which we see a lot of agribusiness big players these days introducing a big amount of new technology like the blockchain, like AI, all for the purpose of streamlining in their language, for the purpose of streamlining the supply chain. So how do you think the net effect of this streamlining of supply chain played into the price factor? Would the streamlining of the supply chain really make, at the end of the day, the price of the commodities, the grains, everything cheaper, mm-hmm. or it might have a reverse effect? So this is my question. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So thank you for the question. In terms of now, what I described here now was month-to-month changes. Obviously, month-on-month, you are not going to see any differences from the process of digitalization, from the process of blockchain, streamlining the supply chain, et cetera, et cetera. For that, we need to look at the very broader and longer-term setup of the prices. So what is happening on the prices, if you follow these briefings, I come here every month to speak about developments, and I always speak about how we compare to the peaks which we had before. This is to say that there are many shocks in the market that happen, all right? In March 2022, we talked about extremely high prices. There was the shock of the war in Ukraine and how we are going to get those supplies. Then we talk about impact of weather events. We are talking about other additional shocks, impact of trade policies, for example. So with all these things that are happening within the supply chains, it is hard, without a detailed study, to attribute how this progress that is being done within the agribusiness firm is helping. However, by introducing these changes, what happens is that they are lowering the cost of doing business. All right. So the cost of transaction, the cost of moving goods from one spot to another, the logistical cost, that is not the shipping cost, which has other issues. We spoke about the Panama Canal. We spoke about the sea crisis last year. The Red Sea crisis still continues. The Panama Canal right now, the situation has improved. So there are many other factors that are in play. But nevertheless, the efforts to streamline the logistics are certainly not hurting the what is happening on the agro-food markets, but it is not a development that, in the taking into account these other shocks, the consumers are going to see immediately. I hope that answers the question at least partially.
This is okay?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it looks like. Any other question for FAO? Thank you. in the room. I don't see online. Let me see. There are no others. So thank you very, very much, Monica, for this. Very important for us to keep track of this important index. So thanks a lot for giving us this update. I'll now go to the colleagues of the Red Cross and Red Crescent. We have with us Erik Tollefsen, who is the head of weapon contamination for ICRC. Sir, you are here to speak about anti-personnel mines and exploded ordnance and munitions and the risk they pose to civilians globally. I'll give you the floor.
Thank you so much, Alessandra. It's very nice to be with you today. This week marks the anniversary of the 27th anniversary of the Mine Ban Convention, and also mentioned earlier here the International Day of Disability or the Disabled. I wanted to address a few contexts of concern, and thank you so much for that introduction. First, let's go to Lebanon. We now see that the ceasefire has taken effect, and we will then have a population that are now trying to return to the homes in the south. It's a population of more than 100,000 that has been moved from the south to the north earlier in the conflict, and are now trying to return to their areas of origin. Of course, what we are seeing there is a lot of evidence of weapon contamination. These are hazards that was not there prior to them leaving, but when coming back, these are new risks that they would be subject to. And our teams are trying to assist as best as we can together with the authorities. But we are afraid that we will see an increase in injuries and harm to the population as a result of the situation. Moving across to Syria, we see a very similar situation now with the very rapid developments over there. And we see masses of population are fleeing from the fighting. What we need to be aware of here is that traditionally to the more than a decade-long war in Syria, the majority of weapon contamination has been along the river and the waterfronts. And this is where the main roads are and when people are trying to get away. So everyone is exposed to risks that they earlier did not have to front. Moving across to Ukraine, as mentioned by the colleague Rick Peppercorn from WHO, winter is coming and it can get really cold in Ukraine. I'm speaking from personal experience. And we are trying to assist population. But of course, what we see is that people will be forced to heat their homes, provide care to the loved ones. And if you enter into forests, into other areas, this is where you find weapon contamination. We also have concerns with the news of states talking about transfer of anti-personnel mines into this particular conflict, as that could further make the situation worse, not just at the immediate time now, but also, of course, in the longer term, as we know that the mines, in particular anti-personnel mines, which are victim activated, are there and are really showing harm mainly to civilians. And what we see is the majority of accidents is happening post-conflict when the hostilities have ceased and people are trying to return to their normal lives. On a personal account, I've worked around the world for many years. I first got involved with the work on weapon contamination in the Middle East in the early 90s, later in the Balkans. At that time, what we saw is no matter of the work we did in terms of clearance of landmines, unexploded ordnance, explosive submunitions from cluster weapons, the accidents were going up. Every year they were rising. And it was only with the introduction of these legal instruments, such as the Mine Ban Convention and later in 2005, the Convention on Cluster Munitions, that we saw this trend being curbed and we saw accidents and victims being reduced. And I think this is important to remember that, you know, the legal instruments was what made the impact in terms of reducing accidents and victims. And then, of course, comes the cleaning up afterwards, all the work, which is time consuming, it is costly, and it's also slightly dangerous. So I'll stop there, but I'm happy to take more comments if there should be any.
Thank you very much, Eric. This is really important. I'll look at the journalist in the room if there is a question. No, so let's go to the platform. Satoko Adachi. Satoko is the correspondent of the Yomiuri Shimbun in Geneva.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can.
Yes, I can.
Thank you very much. I just want to ask about the policy side and anti-landmine treaty here. Last month, U.S. outgoing President Biden approved to supply Ukraine with anti-personnel landmines. And Finland, which is the recently acceded to NATO member, is now considering to reintroduction of the anti-personnel landmines. And I understand you will not answer specific countries' cases, but could you give us your thought on how these policy changes will affect the Ottawa Convention? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that very pertinent question, Satoko. I'm coming from the operational side and have some technical expertise. We have in ICSC some of the finest lawyers that are working on exactly that question to try to find out how we, together with other states and like-minded organizations, can work to ensure that these legal instruments under IHR remain strong. And that we prevent states from when seeing an increased security risk are talking about leaving these conventions. So if you would like to know more about this, you can come back to us and we will set contact with some of our legal colleagues on this.
Adoko, yes, I think you could do that through Christo, whom we have the contacts, but we can also, you can also address us a question in writing if you want, and I can send it to our colleagues of the Office of Disarmament Affairs. John Zarokostas, France 24, and The Lancet.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for this update, and it's good to have someone who's coming with field experience. Can you bring us up to speed based on ICRC field teams? What are you seeing in terms of amputees in various conflict zones, especially in Ukraine and also in Gaza? I understand you have teams in both areas. And secondly, the concerning anti-personnel mines and also clusters, from your experience in the field, what is the failure rate? In other words, what are the duds, those that don't go off and are potentially a ticking time bomb for civilians down the road when hostilities cease? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for those two questions, John. On the first one, I would need to go back and check the data sources, and they will vary. Obviously, in contexts like Gaza, we see very few, if any, victim operated type weapons. There is more the kind of air launched and land service weapons that we see used, which of course causes a particular pattern of harm. Whereas in other contexts, like Ukraine, we see that victim activated victim-activated weapon types are causing a different pattern of harm. But we can look and see whether we can give you the exact data for that. Sorry, could you repeat the second question, please?
Given your field experience, the failure rate of anti-personnel mines or cluster submunitions, the so-called DUDs, you have various estimates. From your experience in the field, what has been a ballpark figure of the failure rates, which down the road are a ticking time bomb for civilians? Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you so much, John. And I'm afraid I can't give you, you know, one ballpark figure which would be correct all across. What we see is there are so many variables in terms of what type of weapon it is, or new or old it is, how it is being deployed, what are the ground conditions, but also the kind of user experience and training of the operators play into this. However, what I can say is that we typically see from manufacturers the quotes that 1% or less failure rate would be the typical figure. But when we approach this and are looking at the conditions at field level, we see, depending on the type, that the failure rate vary. We've seen that, for instance, some of these anti-personnel mines with self-destruct functions that we have found in places like in Ukraine, they have a failure rate on the self-destruct mechanism of higher than 50%. It's more than 50%. In terms of other munitions, air-delivered munitions, we see typically a failure rate between 10 and 15%. Please contact me bilaterally if you would like to discuss this further. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Eric. And there is a question for you from Ria Novosti. Alena, why don't you read it? I can read it for you, but since you had asked for the floor, I give you the floor. Alena Totrova, Ria Novosti. I see she's not taking up the mic, so let me read it for you. So she's asking, does the International Committee of the Red Cross condemn the new delivery of anti-personnel mines that the USA provided to Ukraine? What are the consequences for the civilian population of Ukraine? That's the question that Ria Novosti is asking you.
Yeah. No, thank you for that question, Elena. Again, I'm the head of the department working on the operational consequences of weapon contamination and not on the legal department. And I know that our legal colleagues are working on the response to these news. Please do not hesitate to contact us through our media advisors if you would like to learn more on our response there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And she says thank you on the chat. So thank you, Eric, for this. And thanks very much for the briefing. I don't see other hands up for you. So thanks again. And just to clarify where you were calling from, because it's not in my notes, just the journalists need to know where you were calling from. You're in Geneva, right?
I'm across the road at the ICC headquarters.
Okay, you're in headquarters. Okay, thank you very much. So that's for our colleagues. It's important to know where you're talking, speaking from. So I'll now go to ILO. Zaina, you have an announcement.
Yes, I do. Thank you very much, Alessandra, and good morning, colleagues. I'd like to let you know that the ILO will be issuing our new flagship report on social dialogue on the 11th of December, which is next Wednesday. We'll be holding a virtual press conference at 10:30 in the morning, Geneva local time. The report is going to be looking at the critical role of social dialogue in economic and social development, how we're faring when it comes to social dialogue or dialogue between workers, employers, organizations, and governments, especially in light of the environmental and digital transitions that we are seeing at the moment and ahead of the UN 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. The findings build on surveys, data, and reviews, they are quite comprehensive. Our Assistant Director General for Governance, Rights and Dialogue, Ms. Manuela Tomei, will present the dialogue via the online press conference with support from technical colleagues. Now, all the report and all associate material will be available in a couple of hours from now under strict embargo until 10:30 a.m. CET Geneva local time, which is 9:30 a.m. GMT on the day of the press conference, which is the 11th of December. We'll be sharing the media advisory at some point today, probably in the afternoon. So everything that I've shared with you now will be available in your inboxes quite soon. And we have spokespeople available for interviews should there be an interest in speaking to one of them. And that's it for me. Thank you. Back to you, Alessandra.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And as you said, you'll announce it with all the details very, very soon. Any question to ILO on this press conference and report? I don't see any. So thank you very much, Zeina. Good luck with the launch. And Catherine Wissou for UNCTAD also has an announcement for the Global Commodities Forum.
Est-ce que vous m'entendez?
Oui.
Oui, je crois que oui. Bonjour à tous. Mon annonce est en français, mes notes seront en anglais. Brièvement, donc la CNUSED va organiser la semaine prochaine le Forum mondial des produits de base. Ce sera lundi et mardi au Palais des Nations. C'est une conférence multipartite qui va débattre des enjeux qui se posent aux différents acteurs des chaînes de valeur des produits de base liés à l'agriculture, aux minéraux et à l'énergie, toujours avec un angle pays en développement. Le thème de la 10e session, donc de ce forum, est les produits de base face à l'urgence climatique, commerce durable et valeur ajoutée. Il y aura donc des acteurs du service public, privé, des organisations internationales, des représentants du monde universitaire. Et les enjeux seront ceux liés à la production, aux échanges et à la valorisation des produits de base face au changement climatique. Il y aura 4 sessions particulières qui seront examinées par les intervenants. L'adaptation à la transition énergétique dans les pays en développement qui dépendent des combustibles fossiles. La promotion des fibres naturelles dans le programme d'action en faveur du climat. Comment favoriser le commerce durable des produits de base, le rôle des normes et de la traçabilité dans ce domaine, très important point, et le cas particulier des minéraux essentiels à la transition énergétique. Pour vous donner une idée des participants que vous trouverez vous trouvez la liste des orateurs sur le lien que vous aurez dans les notes. Il y aura par exemple des représentants du Global Gas Center, le directeur de la Sonatrach, le Bremen Cotton Exchange. On a une grande variété de participants. Un des responsables de Woolmark, nos pulls qui tiennent si chaud en cet hiver précoce. Et puis l'OMC, l'International Coffee Organization. Et j'en passe, il n'y a pas de priorité donnée à ceux que je nomme. Il y a une liste qui est abordable sur le site et je ne vais pas passer plus de temps à les lister ici. Bien sûr, nos experts sont à votre disposition pour répondre à vos questions, vous donner des nouvelles de ce forum au cours des 2 jours. Et l'ouverture sera faite par la secrétaire générale. Ce sera en salle 19 du Palais des Nations. C'est tout pour moi. Merci.
Merci beaucoup. Catherine, and questions to UNCTAD, let me see on the platform. Don't see any. So yeah, thank you very much for this update and the note in English, as you say. I have read to you, I think, all the, there is one update that Solange has just sent me about the press conference. So we've already spoken about the one on Monday by Volker Türk. We have already spoken about the one on Friday of the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. There is a new one that I think has just been announced to you. That's Wednesday, 11th December at 1:30 p.m. And it's about the human rights violation in Gaza and across the occupied Palestinian territory. The speakers will be Francesca Albanese, Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Palestinian Territory Occupied since 1967. Margaret Satterwhite, the Special Rapporteur on the Independence of Judges and Lawyers. Ben Saul, the Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms While Countering Terrorism. And George Katrugalos, the Special Rapporteur on the Promotion of Democratic and Equitable International Order. So that's the last, the new one, which has been announced. Now, just to clarify, So we need now the announcement about the ILO one, which I understand well is also on the 11th. Three International Day, tomorrow is International Civil Aviation Day, and the 9th is International Anti-Corruption Day, but also, I shouldn't say above all, but an important day, which is the International Day of Commemoration and Dignity of the Victims of the Crime of Genocide and of the Prevention Against this Crime, and you have received the statement of the Secretary General. So if there are no other question to me, I'd like to conclude this briefing by saying happy birthday, Akano. You know, we mark this year, together with our friends of Akano, the 75th anniversary. Maeva is here in representation of the committee. But of course, all the Akano members are to be congratulated for this incredible 75 years of bringing the voice of the UN family in Geneva, outside Geneva, and to the world. And we thank you very much for the cooperation and often the criticism that you offer us. It brings us, makes us better. And so happy anniversary. I hope we'll celebrate more tonight. That's it. So for me, if there are no other questions, I'll see you on Tuesday and wish you a very good weekend. Thank you.